Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. We have two cases today. The first case is In Re BM. We will hear oral argument from three counsel. Captain McCroskey, are you prepared to argue on behalf of appellant?
Yes, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Colonel Burkhart, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Captain Hotar, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the real party in interest in this case? Very well. Then please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Justice Olson, members of the court. May it please the court. I am Captain April McCroskey. I represent Major BM. May I please reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal?
Granted.
Thank you, Your Honor. This court should remand the case with an order to lift the abatement and to return the mental health records to my client because the military judge erred in conducting an in-camera review without following the proper procedures laid out in MRE 513E. We are asking this court to enforce the holding in Millett. This court in Millett recognized that the term protected in 513 acknowledges that documents that are not themselves communications may be partially privileged to the extent that those records memorialize or otherwise reflect the substance of privileged communications. In this case, the patient's diagnoses, treatments, and prescriptions pertaining to mental health treatment falls within the scope of MRE 513. B5, and therefore subject to the requirements of MRE 513E.
Now, in your brief, at some points it seems as if you're arguing that 513E even applies to non-privileged records, and the government then responds saying that approach would swallow this court's holding in Millett. Number one, is that characterization of your argument correct? And number two, if that is a correct characterization, why isn't the government correct in its concern?
Your Honor, the first question about our argument, yes, it depends. Because what we're arguing is that whenever the defense is requesting mental health records to get the prescriptions, diagnoses, and treatments, then it automatically triggers MRE 513. This court said,
even if the military judge makes it crystal clear that only the material authorized under Millett is being non-privileged material, even if has direct orders to, let's say, on-post mental health facility, even if the military judge were to have a medical law attorney review it or a taint team or something along those lines, it's your position that, in fact, 513E procedures would still apply?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how is that consistent with Millett?
This court held in Millett that to get to the diagnoses, treatments, and prescriptions, those communications, whenever you're ordering the mental health records, they can be co-mingled. And so you're getting privileged information commingled with non-privileged information, which is what the issue is here. What we had here is the defense bypassed MRE 513. It ended up what essentially became an RCM 703 hearing, mm-hmm. and requested this information. And the judge went through and...
But you said the defense bypassed it. How did the... If to the extent there's an error here, how is it the defense's error? Why isn't it the processing of the materials that... How the privileged and non-privileged materials were segregated and how they were dealt with by the military judge? Isn't that really what we're talking about?
That is one of the issues, yes, Your Honor. But the first part of the issue is the fact that it was essentially became an RCM 703 hearing. And I encourage the court to look at the sealed portion of the record where 19 pages was spent just arguing our standing to be able to participate in that hearing whenever we're talking about our client's mental health.
But that's a completely separate issue, right? Well, I just want to make sure, what are we talking about? Because you said the defense bypassed 513. The the defense didn't do anything more than put in a, I mean, seek the production of the records, right? And they have every right to do that, right? And then the military judge has to figure out what to do with that request, right? So I don't, unless you can tell me, unless I'm wrong, I don't think the defense did anything wrong here, right? At least on this, to the extent they requested the production of materials that may or may not have been relevant, that may or may not have been admissible, that may or may not have been privileged. But they don't know, right? They just put in the request. Is there anything wrong with their seeking under Millett and under the rules for court-martial? Is there anything wrong with them seeking production of the records?
No, Your Honor. There's nothing wrong with them seeking production of the records. However, whenever they're seeking that production of the records, the procedures in MRE 513 need to be followed.
But is that defense's role, or is that the military judge should have ascertained that and pivoted? Because I'm sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Go ahead. Okay.
So I guess another way to ask that question is, if the military judge had followed the 703 process up until the point that she received the material and realized there was privileged information, if she had stopped and pivoted and conducted the 503 process at that point, would that satisfy you? I think what we're trying to get at is how then do you get to the 513? The portal has to be either 701 or 703. So you're going to start somewhere, and at some point there's a trigger. And I think we are struggling to determine what is your position about where's the trigger.
Your Honor, the trigger is whenever mental health records are being requested in general. That is then triggers MRE 513. And I agree that the judge should have went ahead and gone into an MRE 513 hearing at the pretrial discovery hearing.
Isn't that exactly what she did? I mean, before these records were produced, didn't she step through the process in 513E? Step one, right? In any case which production or remission of records or communication of a patient other than the accused is a matter in dispute, a party may seek an interlocutory ruling by the military judge. Isn't that exactly what happened? Wasn't there a hearing about whether, before any of these documents were produced, didn't the military judge have a hearing about whether or not these records would be produced?
She did have a hearing, Your Honor. However, she had a hearing under RCM 703. She did not follow all the procedures laid out in MRE 513E.
Well, are we talking about E3 or are we talking about E1 and 2? Because in my reading, E1 and 2 apply to all medical records that are requested under 513. And E3 is very specific to privileged records. So if there had been no privileged records, if the medical facility had done a perfect job of redacting these records and produced non-privileged records under 513, if that had been the case, was anything that happened here improper? Did the military judge make a mistake in how she processed these records?
Yes, Your Honor. She did make a mistake in how she processed this records, because the order should never have been written originally, because the proper procedures in MRE 513 were not properly followed. She didn't go through all the steps of 513E.
Well, which step in E1 or E2 did she miss?
She didn't, the judge did not follow 513E3.
Okay, so now we're talking about E3. E3 has to do with privileged records, right? I mean, I think that's how I read it. You can tell me if I'm reading it incorrectly. It says, the military judge may examine the evidence or proffer thereof in camera if such examination is necessary to rule on the production or admissibility of protected records or communications. Right? So I read that as saying so we've been through a whole process in 1 and 2, and then we get down to E3, and it's talking about protected records. Aren't those records that are protected by the privilege, or are those something else? Like, what is E3 talking about if it's not talking specifically about records that might be privileged under the privilege?
E3, Your Honor, is talking about the mental health records, which are protected underneath the privilege.
Okay. So had there been no, if the redaction had been perfect of these medical records and there were no privileged materials in them, then would we have ever gotten to E3? We wouldn't have, right? We would have done E1, then we would have done E2, and unless I'm reading the record incorrectly, that's pretty much what happened. And then the military judge would have issued a ruling about whether or not the records would have been produced, right? Is that how you read these rules, or do we have a different understanding?
Your Honor, we read the rule as in its entirety, the plain language of the rule.
So you read E3 as applying to all the records that might be mental health records, not just privileged records?
Correct, Your Honor. It pertains to all mental health records.
And what is, if you read the rule that way, what is the purpose of E1 and E2? Wouldn't we just have E3? If that were how it worked, wouldn't we just have E3? Why do we need two different processes in E1 and E2, one process laid out, and then a different process laid out in E3 with different requirements? What's the president doing when he lays out E1 and E2 and then E3 separately? Like, how do we make sense of that? Like, maybe you're right, right? So explain to me, if that's what this means, how do we make sense of E1, E2, and E3 if E3 is referring to all mental health records, not privileged mental health records?
Your Honor, all the factors of 513E are read in order and should be followed before the mental health records are ordered. I guess I'm not really understanding completely your question.
Well, it seems like there's this process laid out in E1 and E2 that talks about what the military judge needs to do before mental health records are produced. And then we get to E3, and there's a different process with different requirements. And I'm just confused. If E3 applies to all mental health records and not privileged mental health records, what is the point of E1 and E2?
The point of E1 and E2, Your Honor, is to give proper notice. A motion must be filed, and then an opportunity to go ahead and respond to that motion. And it also gives the SVC in this particular case, it gives us more of a standing to argue at trial. Like I mentioned earlier, in this sealed appendix, 19 pages was spent with us trying to show that we had standing to argue under RCM 703. This court has said in Millett that once you request the mental health records, that it automatically triggers MRE 513E because those records, to get to the prescriptions, diagnoses, and treatments, the confidential communications, those can be privileged. They might be partially privileged. And so all the requirements of MRE 513 have to be followed in that particular order about the motion being filed and then the four prongs before issuing an order to request to do an in-camera review.
Counsel, can I shift gears and take you back to the start of your argument? You've asked it for two remedies. You want the abatement lifted and you want an order that the records be returned. I want to ask about each of them. The real party in interest says that your client is not affected by the abatement, and therefore that you don't have standing to make this argument. And then secondly, what is the status of the records? Have you requested the records to be returned from the trial by the trial court, or would we be the first one ruling on that? Is there anything in the record about where those records are now?
To your first question, Your Honor, about standing, my client, we do have standing under Article 6B as well as LRM versus Kassenberg. But also the point is my client—
On the specific issue of abatement, why does that affect your client? How are you injured by the abatement?
Because, Your Honor, my client was not able to be heard. She was not able to go and participate in the court-martial proceeding.
So your claim is not so much the abatement, but just that your client was injured by not being able to be heard on the abatement.
Well, also to the abatement itself, Your Honor, because the judge relied on Peyton O'Brien to issue the abatement. which Peyton O'Brien reads the constitutional exception back into UMRE 513, which the president, at the direction of Congress, explicitly removed.
What is the status of the records?
The status of the records, Your Honor, it's my understanding that those are still, that they were sealed and are still with the court.
And you haven't made a request to have them returned?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Getting to the second point, like what we discussed about the military judge, when
Counsel,
she...
Counsel, you'll need to keep it quick. You have 3 seconds left.
Okay.
Now, if you... I'd like to ask my colleagues on the bench, do you have any questions that you'd like to pose?
No, Chief.
You have reserved time.
Yes, Your
And
Honor.
You're free to use that time.
Yes, Your Honor.
When you come back up.
Thank you.
Thank you. Lieutenant Colonel Burkhart.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Colonel James Burkhart, and along with Colonel Joseph Jennings, we represent the United States. 513 does not cover non-privileged records, and Peyton O'Brien should be overturned. I'd like to first address Peyton O'Brien and the constitutionality of 513. It's unresolved whether the right to a complete defense extends to pretrial discovery, production, or disclosure. However, even if we assume that it does, 513, as currently written, is still constitutional under the Schaefer-Holmes framework. The NMCCA erred in Peyton O'Brien and in this case when it held otherwise, and the military judge, in applying Peyton O'Brien, exceeded her authority by going beyond the plain language of the rule and forcing the victim to choose between disclosure and abatement. And that is error that must be overturned. Under their make rules authority.
Now, under Peyton O'Brien, your argument there, you say that the CCA didn't have the authority to create a remedy.
Yes, Your Honor.
So what is a court to do when a right has been created or exists and it's being violated? Is a court supposed to just at that point say that the person who is aggrieved is out of luck, that there is no means or mechanisms by which a court can vindicate those rights if they're violated?
Yes, Your Honor, so look towards the constitutional framework. And the constitutional framework in this case is Schaefer-Holmes, where they can establish rules that infringe upon that right to a complete defense so long as they're not arbitrary or disproportionate. So in one case, we'd be looking at that framework and assessing that infringement under that framework and whether it's arbitrary or disproportionate to the purpose it's designed. And that didn't happen in this case. There's not that assessment.
So, but we're talking about, I believe, two different things. You're asking about the application of it to this case. I'm asking the broader question that seemed consistent with the argument in your brief, that Peyton O'Brien, when the CCA said that there is this mechanism to address it, that the government is saying, no, the CCA did not have that authority at all.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd be looking towards the RCMs and the two-step process. One is identifying, is there the error going towards Schaefer-Holmes in that analysis? And our argument is they're not in this case.
And I'm sorry, I just want to make sure I'm following you. I don't mean to cut you off. When you're referring to the error, is the error the application of 513? I just don't want to attribute error to the wrong thing.
Yes, Your Honor, it's not applying Schaefer-Holmes to 513.
Okay,
or
all right.
Recognizing that there is a requirement to go beyond the plain language of the rule. Here we have plain language. We have plain language with disclosure in Echo 4, saying that the military judge can only do disclosure. The requirement is only to meet those exceptions. Congress and the President have struck that balance. They've made that determination within the constitutional framework. And unless that determination is arbitrary or disproportionate, then that holds, and then you follow the rule. That's that constitutional framework there looking at that. Recognize, Chief Judge, if in the sense of like any other privilege, right, in regards to a remedy, there's an as-applied challenge to that. We recognize that there's some talk about there when it comes to privileges. The government is unaware of a SCOTUS holding, or this case's holding, when it comes to that. They've discussed it, but unaware of a particular holding. Our argument is it doesn't meet that first. In this case, it doesn't meet that first prong of going towards the remedy, Your Honor.
Counsel, can I take you back to the argument about Congress or the President removing the constitutional exception in 513. If you go back to the 2012 manual and you read it, the exception said there is no privilege if this information is constitutionally required to be disclosed. The military judge did not suggest that there is no privilege. I mean, it's a slightly different, but I think importantly different, distinction, which she said now it is privileged, but you can't proceed against the defendant unless he receives this information. Whereas I understand under the 2012 manual, it wouldn't be privileged. You'd have to turn it over. And so it's not really the same thing, is it, as returning this back to establishing the constitutional exception to the privilege, because the material still is privileged. So what we're really talking about is, can you proceed against the accused without giving him the information?
Yes, Your Honor. So we agree with the Peyton O'Brien part that the privilege is inviolable, that you can't pierce it.
And under the old law, you could pierce it. It didn't exist.
Yes, Your Honor. And with the change, so the one is you can't pierce it. What's happened is establishing this decision, enforcing that decision, is tantamount to that. And it's tantamount to creating and going beyond the disclosure requirements.
It isn't really tantamount to it because here, no, the privilege hasn't been abrogated. The privilege exists. I mean, it's true you can't proceed against the client, but against the defendant, but it's not the exact same thing at all.
Well, Your Honor, so in Echo 4, it talks about both production, which would go towards piercing that privilege, but it also talks about disclosure. And so within the plain language of the statute is disclosure. Disclosure is also limited only to those enumerated exceptions. And so by forcing that issue of one or the other and the abatement in a case in which she is a named victim creates that tantamount or that
But there is no order of disclosure here. There can be no order of disclosure.
So the military judge determined that disclosure was required. And that is
conditionally required. If you're going to proceed with the case, you have to disclose it. But she never said that the information had to be disclosed.
Correct, Your Honor. But by forcing the issue there, it is tantamount, and it creates that same concern.
But I don't understand. Like, why? The government has a choice, right? And the victim has a choice. She has a privilege. The military judge hasn't violated it. She can agree to the disclosure of the materials, or the government can drop the case, or they can try and proceed without it.
And yes, Your Honor, Congress and the President, under that makes rules authority, with deference that they receive, have determined that the ways to do that are through the enumerated exceptions. They foreclosed the other options.
To order production,
Your Honor.
And no production has been ordered.
Or to when it would be required. And so when the court is saying that
then that backs up to a slightly different issue. So the President can't, if the Constitution requires the production of materials under due process before you can proceed with a criminal conviction, the President can't override that, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So the military judge is of the view, I think we can assume, that there were materials that the Constitution required be produced before the prosecution proceeded. And when they weren't going to be produced, she said, that's it. So we're stopping. She didn't violate the privilege. She just said, the Constitution requires these materials. I don't know if she's right about that or not, but that's what she believed. And then and no one seems to be objecting to that part of her ruling. So then she said, all right, if they're not going to be produced, we're done. Right? So what part of that aspect of what she did she get wrong?
Leaving out that analysis, the Schaefer-Holm analysis of finding that the rule was, at least in this particular circumstance, is disproportionate to the purpose. Congress and the President are not excluding constitutionally required evidence. What they're doing is, through the constitutional framework, determining that this limited narrowly tailored amount of evidence is not constitutionally required.
But do they have the ability to do that? Where do they get the – where do the President and Congress have the authority to say that these things that would be required, say, in an Article III court to be produced are not going to be constitutionally required in the military justice system, which is, I think, what you're suggesting they've done.
Yes, Your Honor. So the make rules clause, starting there and then going down into the UCMJ with 36, with that delegation with the President, and then that's under the Schaefer-Holmes. The rulemaker under Holmes and Schaefer, the rulemaker can pass rules. They have broad authority. They get Weiss deference. They can pass rules that infringe upon the complete defense, so long as it's not arbitrary and disproportionate to the
right.
purpose.
And is that what Congress did here? Like, we have an executive order, right? We're in a kind of weird situation here, right? The President issued an executive order. I'm not sure that there's any precedent that says just purely on his own and through an executive order the President can do this. Mm-hmm. Now we have this weird situation where Congress ordered the President to change his executive order, which is a weird thing. I don't know if that's the same as legislation or not. So they didn't put it in an article. They ordered the President to change his executive order. So what should we infer from – you're saying we should infer from that that Congress meant to eliminate the constitutional exception for all – in the military justice system writ large, right? Is that essentially what you're saying we should infer from what Congress did when they ordered the President to change his executive order?
Yes, Your Honor, that they acted in there. We provide a presumption of validity that it's constitutional what they do. In the 2015 NDAA is when they do that, to cooperate or craft that together with the President. And so we should assume that what they did has meaning when they removed that, the Delta 8, the constitutional exception, and it has constitutional meaning. And you get constitutional meaning under the Schaefer-Holmes framework.
Now, why would we infer, why would we infer that Congress was doing that? I think a different argument, a different interpretation is the exception, except for ordering production, was never necessary in the first place. Like, most rules for court-martial don't have an exception for unless the Constitution requires otherwise. Here there was one, and you could say it was specifically for production. Why don't we think maybe Congress just looked at that and said, like, why do we have a constitutional exception in this one rule? We don't have it anywhere else. Like, how do we know what Congress really meant to do? You want us to infer that they meant to eliminate a constitutional protection in the military justice system writ large, right? And maybe they did, but how do we know that that's what they meant?
Well, under Sobel, yes, Your Honor, there's a presumption of constitutional action, that it's a presumption of constitutionality. And so when they do that, we presume it. And so even if assuming that there was those areas of constitutional concern that Peyton O'Brien points out, prior to you could write the in-camera. When you delete that, it means something. And so with that narrowly tailored portion of, because Peyton O'Brien not operate, when they're operating pre-Millett, didn't have the clarity of what the full scope was. And so in this case, it's so narrowly tailored, it's proportionate. We're only talking about actual communications. And so if you're looking at potential constitutional concerns when it comes to capacity or it comes to the other parts about mental difficulties, the rule that Congress has tailored allows all that other stuff to come in. There is nothing exclusive, an exclusive connection between actual communications and those constitutional concerns. And so by Congress allowing those things, you can allow the diagnosis, prescriptions, and treatments to go towards those areas of constitutional concerns. And I think this is exemplified by the RPI cited the Arizona case from the Supreme Court. And under a different framework, one when we're looking at states or the federalists recognize they're under a different framework, whereas here we have explicit constitutional authority from the Congress and from the President that have crafted a rule. And in that case, you have a defendant that murders a girlfriend, claims self-defense, and then seeks the mental health records. Under their framework, they determined that there was constitutional concerns and due process required in-camera review. But if you look at how narrowly tailored R513 is, and you apply that to that same fact pattern, we have an exception that deals with dead patients, and we have a more limited scope. So the other things they were looking into, diagnosis, prescription, and treatments, Congress has allowed that to satisfy any concerns we would have with those constitutional concerns that Peyton O'Brien mentioned. And so that's where, because it's so narrowly tailored, especially in light of the Millett holding and the reading there, it satisfies the proportionality of that. It goes to a transcendent purpose. It goes to the mental health of the armed forces. And it's tailored to achieve that, Your Honor.
Counsel, could I ask you a question here? On the constitutionally required information or not, and I'm not saying the judge, let's put aside for the moment the ruling that the judge in this case made. There could be a question whether or not she should have been that far down into the records to begin with, and it could be a question whether or not she made the right call on the constitutionally required. But on the notion of constitutionally required evidence, do you agree that there can be a situation where a communication to the psychotherapist so undermines the prosecution of the case that it is truly exculpatory evidence? It truly exculpates the accused in a given situation. Do you agree that there might be some, in other words, it doesn't fit any of the other exceptions in 513, so it's outside of those exceptions, but it is a communication that is truly exculpatory. And in fact, if this communication were entered into the record against the government's case, there basically wouldn't be a case. Now, that sounds like an extreme hypothetical, but play along with me here. What do you do with that information? What happens if the judge is properly conducting the in-camera review and finds that?
Yes, Your Honor. So there you would apply the Schaefer-Holmes test. It's, in that case, an as-applied challenge, and recognizing the proportionality of that. As a society, we've determined and that there's some balances, that there's some infringements on that, and to be able to protect actual communications beyond just that case creates a benefit to society. It's the societal benefits that Jaffe talks about that gets imported in here through Rodriguez that mentions there. So to an extreme case like that, you would apply the same. Now, that there's instances like in Jasper with other privileges. That was a priest-penitent privilege with that. Now, that got resolved on waiver. But we know, it's possible that it happens in other cases as well, Your Honor, but it would be applying that in that case a potential as applied challenge.
Well, can you apply that to my hypothetical, and where do you come out?
In something that's so exculpatory, I think one thing would be to, per the rule, to look at, is there other sources to achieve that same thing of not having to divulge the actual communication?
Well, suppose there isn't. This is a communication made directly to the psychotherapist. Yeah. And the psychotherapist can't disclose it because it may not necessarily be one that suggests that the patient is a danger to himself or others or is going to go out and commit a crime. But it is so exculpatory as to undermine the prosecution fully.
Yes, Your Honor, I think there's rules on mistrial. There's rules on other things like that that potentially come into play in procedures and processes of developing that remedy in that particular situation.
But are you answering my hypothetical and saying that instance that might be an example of something that's constitutionally required and the judge ought to come up with a remedy other than disclosure, or what are you suggesting with regard to my hypothetical?
In regard to your hypothetical, Your Honor, in the sense of it's conclusively constitutionally required,
mm-hmm.
right, then there are other things within the manual for court-martial, already rules that are in there that could address that, such as mistrial.
Other than disclosure is what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
I see. Okay.
In Your Honor, this is not a matter of judicial preference. Right? This isn't a matter within the splits among the states or the federal courts. This is Congress has already made a determination. The President and Congress have already made the determination, and they're owed due deference with that. And this would be constitutional of any potential.
But how do we know? I'm still a little, you're adamant that what they meant to do was eliminate, right, the privilege entirely. But you've also admitted, both to me and I think to Judge Sparks, that there could be things, like they can't eliminate the privilege entirely. They can eliminate it out of 513. And the effect of eliminating it out of 513 is it means there's no longer a mandate that it be produced, right? And so why couldn't that be all they meant to do? All they wanted to do was eliminate this rule that allowed military judges to overcome the privilege and mandate that things be produced. Now they can't do that anymore. Why isn't that enough? Isn't that possibly exactly what Congress wanted to do? They thought that was unfair. They thought it wasn't appropriately respectful of the privacy of victims. And so they said, look, we're not going to let military judges require this to be produced anymore without eliminating the privilege to writ large in the entire military justice system. Like, how do we know? That those are, I think, two reasonable things that Congress might have been thinking when they ordered the President to change his executive order. How do we know which one? One is a fairly narrow thing, and one is a very broad thing. How do we know which one they meant?
In Your Honor, I see my time is up.
Please
I
respond
can answer the question.
To Judge Hardy's question.
Your Honor, I think it's also looking at the other statutory frameworks, where Congress knows in 505 or 506 they knew how to make remedies, and they knew how to tailor that, or in 704 when it comes to testimony immunity, and they didn't here. And so I think that goes into that assumptions in what we do with statutory construction when we're looking at the entire structure.
A remedy for what? I mean, I don't see how your answer about remedies answers my question about how we know what Congress was up to when they ordered the President to change his executive order. Were they doing something narrow which says we're going to eliminate the authority of military judges to order the production of these materials? Or were they eliminating the privilege to the extent that they can writ large in the military justice system? It's an honest question. How do we know which of those two, I think, reasonable interpretations they meant?
In Your Honor, the principles of statutory construction and what we have here is the plain language of the statute that they passed with that. And in light of other things that they've passed, such as the recent LeBrandon Act and the other concerns that they have of with that. But it'd be towards the statutory construction and going through that steps of starting with the language, looking at the rest of the statute, and the other parts that are involved with that. And to briefly conclude, Peyton O'Brien should be overturned.
Further questions? Seeing none, thank you, Captain Brooker. Captain Hodar.
Thank you. Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, may it please the court, Captain Colin Hoser on behalf of the Rogue Part Interest, Lieutenant Commander Dominic Bailey. This case is about a military judge who is in the possession of exculpatory evidence. Evidence the lower court found was rarely this material to a defense. But Lieutenant Commander Bailey does not have access to this evidence. The military judge protected his right to a fair trial when she obeyed this proceeding, and this court should answer the certified issues in the negative for two reasons. First, the military judge did not violate Emory 513 when she ordered production of the Millett material. And secondly, after the appellant refused to waive disclosure of the privileged communication, the military judge had an obligation to ensure a fair trial. First, I want
to... Counsel, on the first point, did the military judge follow all the procedures in 513E3 when she discovered what she believed to be privileged information in the medical records?
No, Your Honor, she did not.
All right. So first of all, what do we do about that? Right. She plowed ahead, right? And I think she was trying to protect the defendant's constitutional rights, but in doing so, she didn't follow the procedures that the President has set out for what to do when she thinks she's discovered privileged records, right? So if that's an error, first of all, like, how do we deal with that?
Your Honor, it's not an error. 513 Echo 3 applies when two factors are met. When a party is seeking privileged communication and an in-camera review is necessary to rule on that motion. Here, neither factor was present. The party was not seeking privileged communication or seeking Millett material. And secondly, the in-camera review was done for the benefit and at the request of the appellant. So 513 Echo 3.
Yeah, but the request for the in-camera review was specifically to ensure that there weren't privileged materials commingled with the non-privileged materials.
Right, Your Honor. And if I could just take a step back and kind of go through the timeline of events and help get to how we get to the in-camera review. So at a 39A session, a closed 39A session, the defense moves for production of Millett material. The government concedes and agrees that this evidence should be produced, but the appellant refused to produce this evidence. Right? So instead, she asked the military judge to conduct that in-camera review to ensure no commingled material was mixed in with the Millett material. What the military judge did afterwards was ensure that she gave a specific order which only requested, it was crystal clear, only requested Millett material. After she gets it, she realizes that it also contains commingled material.
But that's the key point. I don't think anyone is on the government side, or at least on your side, would argue that any of that process was wrong. What we're focusing on right now in terms of your argument is what was the military judge required to do upon discovering privileged material? We're not saying that the real party in interest did anything wrong in terms of requesting Millett material, or that the military judge had done anything wrong proceeding from there. The question is, what happens when, through no fault of the military judge's actions or of the real party in interest, says, but I find there's material that was non-responsive that is privileged. What was the military judge required to do then? And did she do it?
Your Honor, 2 points. Emory 513 does not dictate how a military judge is to act in this scenario. As discussed, 513 Echo 3 is what governs in-camera reviews. And those two factors, a party's requesting privilege, and additionally, in-camera review is necessary to rule in that motion, are the factors that triggers Echo 3. Inadvertent disclosure does not bring us back to 513 Echo 3.
Now, why is that, though?
Why is that, Your Honor?
Yes.
Because the rule doesn't state that, Your Honor.
So we're supposed to look at this rule very narrowly, that in this type of scenario, if what had been presented to the military judge was the entire mental health records, clearly there had been no scrubbing of those records whatsoever, military judge should just say, it's all fair game. I don't have to go through any procedures at all here.
Your Honor, after the judge realized that there was commingled material, she gave notice to the parties. This is on Joint Appendix 99 through 101. It's email traffic where she gives notice to her parties of her intent. After the fact that this appellant has already requested this in-camera review, the military judge gives notice that she's going to go through the records and redact the privileged communication and provide that Millett material. No objection from the appellant. She didn't file a motion. She didn't object. She didn't request a 39A session.
Well, what in her mind was the specific credible factual basis demonstrating a reasonable likelihood that the privileged records or communications would contain or lead to the discovery of evidence admissible under an exception to the privilege? Like, right? That's E3A, right? That's the first step. Like, what was, and I don't think the record tells us, what was the specific credible factual basis?
Well, Your Honor, our position is that E3 was not triggered. Paragraphs 1 and 2 was, but paragraphs E3 was not triggered based on when the facts unfolded. And then secondly, even if it was, the appellant requested an in-camera review or was given notice of this in-camera review and did not object.
But the reason, isn't it apparent from the record that the reason they didn't object is because they wanted to make sure that the record was scrubbed of any privileged material. So it was for that narrow purpose.
Your Honor, and let me just go back to the timeline. So at the 39A session, she asked for the in-camera review. She asked for it to ensure that there's no commingled material. After the military judge receives these documents from the VA, she realizes, oh, there's commingled material. And what does she do? She gives notice. The military judge gives notice to the parties. That was the time to object. That was the time to file a motion.
So is your argument essentially that if there was error, then the error was forfeited?
It's two parts, Your Honor. It is forfeit or waived, and then secondly, that Emory 513 Echo 3 does not apply in this scenario.
Is there any affirmative relinquishment of the right to the privilege?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So then we're just in forfeiture world. So let's just say you're right about that, and we're in plain error. Like, I still don't know how the military judge followed any of the steps in 513E3. I still don't know what the specific credible factual basis was for her to even look once she discovered privileged records, especially in a judge-alone trial. I know we assume that the military judges are superhuman who can keep, you know, things separate in their minds. But even so, why is she even looking at it, right? If she hasn't done any of the steps in 513E3 that it says prior to conducting an in-camera review, she has to do these things. So how do we get around that?
Your Honor, she is doing what the appellant asked her to do. And this comes from Joint Appendix page 67. She refused to produce the documents, which is fine. She said that she is not required to create or produce evidence, and there is no rule requiring a victim to create an exhibit for defense. Joint Appendix page 67. She is doing, and she asked for the in-camera review. She is doing, the appellant has washed her hands clean and has asked the military judge to go through and redact these documents, and she is doing what the appellant has asked her to do.
Counsel,
go ahead, Judge Maddox.
Coming back up to the start of your brief, before you get into the merits, you say that the appellant lacks standing, and one of the things that the appellant is asking for is that we lift the abatement, and you say, well, the appellant hasn't been injured because the privilege hasn't been violated, and the appellant isn't injured by the abatement. And I think I understood counsel to say, well, there was an injury because the appellant wasn't properly heard on whether there should be an abatement. What is your response to that question? That's my first question. The second is, if we agree with you that there's no standing, what do we do with these questions? Do we answer them? Do we dismiss the appeal? What do we do?
To answer the latter question first, the remedy would be to dismiss the certified issue. Back to the first question, standing, our argument for standing was both in regards to the first issue and the second issue. So to the first issue, it goes to an issue of mootness. She was given notice, and she failed to object to the military judge reviewing and redacting the privileged communication. If she took issue and she filed her motions and she asked for an A session, she certainly could have filed it right then, but she didn't. As to the second issue of non-justiciability,
let me ask on that first part. Even if the judge had followed all the procedures, she couldn't have gotten a better remedy than she's got now, which is that the privilege has been protected. Doesn't that eliminate an injury?
Yes, Your Honor, and that goes towards the second issue. Both the government and the appellant argue that there's a constitutional exception, that the CCA recreated this constitutional exception, and that is simply not the case. If there was a constitutional exception, the privilege could simply be pierced. But her privilege is still intact. She still has, it is still integral, and she still has full protection of Emory 513. So, right, there is no injury as far as an abatement, Your Honor.
But she says she's injured by the abatement itself.
My argument is that she has no right to a trial. The Ropar interest has constitutional rights. She has no right to a court-martial proceeding.
And what about her separate argument that she's entitled to get the records back? What's your response on that?
Well, Your Honor, and to answer the question, the records are with the clerk of courts. We've all seen the CO records, and it's with this court. So it is not with the military judge. We have access to it. I'm sorry, did that answer your question?
No, could you just restate what you just said?
The sealed medical records are with the clerk of courts.
Okay.
With this clerk of court.
Yes, Your Honor.
And then you said you had access to it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
As well as the government.
And do you have any objection to our ordering those records to be returned? Provided that the abatement still stands.
No, Your Honor. I let me think that through. and I apologize for not having a better answer, but as I think this through, if the abatement stands, we wouldn't object to the records being returned.
You would not object?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Thank you, Chief. Can I go back to this point you made while discussing the point that Judge Hardy was making? And it has to do with what the appellant, the petitioner in this case, should or should not have done, should have objected. Why is there any onus at all on the patient victim in this case to do anything like objecting? Why should that control what the military judge does? Under 701G, I think it is, the military judge has broad responsibility for the regulation of discovery in the case. So why, if she's supposed to do something, why is she absolved just because the victim in this case didn't object or didn't ask for something? The rules are set forth. The military judge knows what the rules are and can decide how this discovery issue should or can be resolved. You seem to be relying earlier on the fact that the victim in this case, the appellant, did not object or did object or did ask for this or didn't ask for that. Well, I just don't understand why there's any onus on her to do any of that.
And let me clarify, Your Honor.
And maybe I misunderstood you.
No, and that's correct. It is certainly a factor that she did not object to the in-camera view, but right, the military judge had this discretion. And this United States v. Warda, this court recently stated that an in-camera review respects a defendant's need for evidence and that privacy interest of a witness. So yes, that was well within her discretion to conduct that in-camera review, regardless of Emory's 513 Echo 3.
Okay.
Counsel, I have a question. What is the best, what will we point to? There's dispute about whether or not abatement was even a remedy that the military judge could have ordered in this circumstance. What is the best source of that authority, either in the rules or somewhere else in the code, that we would look to justify the abatement order?
Yes, Your Honor, and there's multiple avenues to get the abatement, but they all lead to an abatement. It's RCM 703 Echo 2 or the Constitution. That's Pennsylvania v. Ritchie. That's this court's precedent in United States v. Romano, United States v. Zayas. A military judge may not sit idly by when faced with exculpatory evidence. She must fashion a remedy which gives consideration to a defendant's due process and fair trial rights. That's what this military judge did, well within her discretion. She fashioned a remedy which gave consideration to Lieutenant Commander Bailey's due process rights. So while the constitutional exception was certainly removed in 2014, the Constitution still applies to this court-martial proceeding, and she acted well within her discretion in crafting that remedy.
Let me ask another question here about this. When the judge decided, let's just put aside again the moment whether or not she had gone too far down the line in looking at the records, just for the moment, what is she using to determine, and what should she be using to determine that this evidence, these communications or evidence she sees or comes upon must be constitutionally required? Because I think in this case there wasn't much leading up to what the accused thought was in the records. You know what I'm asking?
Yes, Your Honor.
So what does the military judge, now we may not know because, you know, there are certain things that are sealed for sure, but what is it under your view that she's looking at and determining that this is constitutionally required? I mean, wouldn't the trial judge need to know a little more about what the defense theory is and what the defense is and a little more information to make that call?
Yes, Your Honor, and I will point to this court's recent decision again, United States v. Warda. This court looked at the importance of the witness, the defense's theory in the case, and they found that evidence which undermined the credibility of a victim was evidence of central importance. So the same can be true here. The what the military judge found was that this evidence, obviously we have a sole witness, the victims, and secondly, she found that this evidence went directly to the defense. So based on the defense is argument in the motions, this evidence went directly to it. So similar to Warda, this evidence was constitutionally required here as well.
Okay, so under your view, from the defense view, she looked at enough and had enough information to make that call, sounds like.
Right, Your Honor. And, okay. And it is important to note that when the military judge is going through these redactions, she states in her order that she attempted to limit her review of the documents. Right? There are certain sections that she didn't review. Additionally, when the documents are eventually, the proposed production of the confident or the privileged communication, it was still heavily redacted. So the military judge isn't doing a wholesale production of the medical records. These documents are still heavily redacted and only pertain to the defense's theory in this case.
So I want to be clear, and this is a follow-up to Judge Hardy's question then. I think of this about us being in a box. You know, as I think I asked the victim's counsel this question. We're in a box, process-wise, so 701 or 703. We're in the 703 box. So it sounds like your argument is that notwithstanding the fact that 513 itself does not contain a remedy, because we are in a box, then the military judge did not err by invoking or using a 703 remedy, or as you said, the other option could have been the constitutional remedy in Pennsylvania v. Ritchie and the other cases. I just want to make sure that I'm tracking the argument. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that's correct.
Okay.
As we stated, the RCM 513 does not contemplate a remedy.
Right.
But generally, evidentiary rules don't contemplate remedies. We look to the RCM for that. And if we look to RCM 703 Echo 2, it certainly provides that the military judge was within her discretion, and she clearly, there was not clear and indisputable clear and indisputable error when she gave the remedy of abetting the proceeding. Any questions, I'll conclude.
Further questions from the bench?
In closing, the military judge fashioned a remedy which protected Lieutenant Commander Bailey's right to a fair trial, and we ask this court to answer the certified issues in the negative. Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Hodar. Captain McCroskey, you reserve time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Please proceed.
Your Honor, we would like to clarify that what we're talking about in this particular case is a privilege. The military judge requested mental health records from the facility to get to the diagnoses, treatments, and prescriptions. Therefore, it triggers MRE 513, and the analysis under MRE 513 should be followed.
Counsel, if the military judge had followed all the procedures in 513 the way you interpret those procedures, wouldn't the result have been exactly the same, that she would have found that these materials were privileged and sealed the records?
No, Your Honor. In fact, if all four prongs for an in-camera review would have been followed, then those records would not have been disclosed to begin with. There are one of the things under the in-camera review is for the defense to show that there are other avenues to get that information without going through privileged sources. And it is our argument that wasn't even considered at this point. Yes, we agree that this court has ruled in Millett that the diagnoses, prescriptions, and treatments in of themselves are not privileged. However, whenever you're requesting that information through privileged sources, such as in this particular case, through the mental health records.
Well, they didn't request it. The request for production was very specifically for non-privileged records, wasn't it?
In her order, yes, Your Honor. However, it was to a mental health facility. So there is that concern that there would be spillage of protected communications.
But that doesn't. Why does that change this concern and the need to be very careful and respect the privileged documents? Why does that change how 513 works? You could say there was negligence or carelessness on behalf of the facility or on behalf of the military judge, or they should have been more respectful of the victim's medical records. But how does that change how 513 works? If there had been no privileged materials, just diagnoses and treatments in the medical records that were produced, we wouldn't be having any of this conversation, right?
Correct, Your Honor. However, though, to put that kind of burden on a medical facility where they have to, I mean, these medical facilities don't have Millett in front of them.
But there are lots of privileges, right? I mean, the privileged information is a thing that comes up in trials all the time. The military, now you can say the military judge failed the victim in this case. And maybe that's true, but that's, but what, that, how does that, inter, I mean, and how does that change how we read 513?
Your Honor, one of the things in the question, though, you were talking about at trial. We are not at trial here. We're at pretrial discovery, and there is no constitutional right to pretrial discovery based on Ritchie, Holmes, and Sheffer. And so it's a different.
So are you saying the military judge erred in ordering the production of the records, of non-privileged records?
Yes, Your Honor. Because she did not follow the proper procedures laid out in MRE 513.
And that's if we agree with you that 513E3 applies to all medical records and not privileged records.
Your Honor, it deals to all mental health records. Whenever you're requesting the non-privileged information through a privileged source, such as the mental health records, then it triggers MRE 513. It's just like the attorney-client privilege or the privilege with the priest and everything. These privileges are put in place to protect the holder of that privilege.
But that also just assumes that all mental health records are privileged. And that's exactly what we held wasn't true in Millett.
Your Honor, in Millett, it was a statutory interpretation of how you read 513A and how it does not apply, that prescriptions, diagnoses, and treatments is not privileged, correct. However, the court did not go further in how we get that information. And then we have the issue that happened in this particular case where the judge did an analysis under RCM 703, and then that caused the spillage of these protected communications. So once these mental health records are requested, then that triggers, like this court said, that MRE 513E applies.
Further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Captain McCroskey. Case is now submitted. The court thanks all of counsel involved in this argument, and we will now stand in recess until 10:45.
Stands in recess until
10:45. What happened? Where am I? What happened?